Wherever you are in the world, thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Badminton Podcast, a community for badminton players by badminton players, proudly brought to you by Velan. We talk all things badminton and aim to inspire you to be better in your game and in life by celebrating the people and stories of our global badminton community, whether they be past or present professional players, social players, officials or fans.
We're your hosts, Jeff and Henry, and we love badminton. From the bottom of our hearts, we'd just like to say thank you to everyone who has listened to, shared, and been part of the podcast. It wouldn't be possible without you all. If you do enjoy our episodes and can spare just a couple of dollars each month, you can really help keep the podcast going by supporting us on Patreon. Just visit www.patreon.com/thebadmintonpodcast. We'll leave the link in the description. The Badminton Podcast is brought to you by Velant. Henry and I founded Velant out of our own frustration with the confusing, bright, and unsightly clothes we saw in badminton all over the world. But now, it's so much bigger than that. Our mission is to simplify the badminton journey and show the world how incredible badminton is. So make sure you check out our badminton basics at velantwear.com and follow us on our socials at velantwear.
So today we're bringing you a past guest of the podcast. In fact, he featured in episode 17 for all those who know our podcast episodes by heart. Since our last conversation, this Danish badminton player has started his very own highly successful podcast, secured a runners-up result in men's singles at the Thailand Open, Toyota Thailand Open, that took place in January this year in 2021, and successfully rebranded Mee Goreng as the go-to food for badminton players in the process. He is world ranked currently number 22nd, I believe. I'll have to double check that. 20th, actually. Currently world ranked 20th, and he is none other than HK Vittinghus.
I have one goal that's bigger than anything, and that's being part of the Thomas Cup team in October in Denmark. I really hope it will be an event with spectators, because playing the Thomas Cup at home is going to be a... I would say almost magical experience if there is going to be a crowd. The Danish badminton community has been so excited for this event ever since we won the host bidding. So I think the community here is so ready for it to happen. And it's a big dream of mine to be part of the team. And obviously when we're there, we don't just want to take part, but we are going to try and go for another gold. There are teams that are on paper better than us, but we can field, especially in men's singles, we can field very strong lineup. So on our day, we can beat any team. So yeah, why not try and go for gold? And that's the biggest goal for me this year, to be part of that team.
Welcome back onto the podcast, HK.
Hey guys, nice to be back. Thanks for the invite.
We're really excited to have another chat to you today, HK. And let's jump right in. Let's talk about your performance at the Thailand Open. Give us a rundown of what happened besides the Mee Goreng.
Yeah, well, the Mee Goreng story is probably the biggest one, which is a little bit crazy. But well, apart from that, it was an amazing trip for me. I boarded the flight in Copenhagen, not knowing if I would get to play or not. I was still on the reserves list at that time. I was ranked 42 in the world, and it's only a draw of 32 players. So I was still on the reserves list, but I thought, I was the first one to get in, so there was a decent chance that I would be promoted before the tournament started. With all these COVID-19 regulations, the chance of someone testing positive or missing a flight. Yeah, just so many things could go wrong. So I thought it was worth the shot to travel anyway. And yeah, while I was in transit in Switzerland on my way to Thailand, I got the confirmation that I was actually in the main draw now. So yeah, that was a big relief, actually, because otherwise, I would have to stay 10 days in quarantine in Thailand without getting to play. That's not really why I wanted to travel there. But obviously, it turned out great and I played amazing. I think I played well in both the two events. We started off with, I think it was the Yonex Thailand Open. I lost first round there, but played well. And then we moved on to play the Toyota Thailand Open the following week. And yeah, I just played better and better until the final. And in the final, I just got absolutely killed on court. But it was a good experience, no doubt.
Yeah, definitely. And when you got confirmation when you were in Switzerland, was that both for the Yonex as well as the Toyota, for both of them at the same time?
Yeah, it was, because everyone had to kind of sign up for, they didn't have to, but everyone signed up for both events. So if you pulled out of the first one, you would also be pulled out of the second one, because you had to arrive, I think it was like a week before the event started, to play any of the events, to be in this green zone or bubble zone that they created. So as soon as I got the confirmation, I knew it was going to be both weeks.
Yep. Yeah, we spoke to Marcus Ellis from England while he was actually in the quarantine. And he was, of course, zooming with Lauren, and she was making funny sound in the background and everything. But how did you find that experience being confined to the hotel room, and you're doing your own exercises and making, like, hitting against the wall or jumping up and down and making lots of noise in the hotel room?
In terms of training, of course, it wasn't the optimal way to prepare for an event. But the whole experience of being quarantined or confined in your hotel room during the entire stay was actually a good experience for me. And I tried to take a bit of a lesson out of it, that those 2 weeks worked really well for me because I had no other business than just preparing for my matches and my tournaments. I only had to relax. I had to train whenever we were able to do that, when we had training time slots. And I needed to prepare for my matches, and that was it. I didn't need to think about going out for dinner or lunch or going out for a coffee with your friends or looking at the city, anything like that. And it's not like I'm on sightseeing usually, but you always want to go out to the restaurants, have a nice dinner and stuff like that. But here you didn't have that option. You could only stay in the room. And it actually really suited me well, because I was just so relaxed and I was so just a bit more focused also in training, because nothing else really took away my focus. So I'm trying to learn a little bit from that in future events, when we go back to a more normal situation where we are actually allowed to go out, that maybe I should tone it down a little bit. I'm not saying I will never go to a restaurant again or go out of the hotel room, but I just think it was a good lesson for me that the more I focus just on my performance and how to prepare best, the higher a chance I have of performing well as well. Of course, it makes sense when you say it like that, but there is just a lot of temptations when you are in another country, in a nice city, usually, and those temptations are kind of gone at the moment.
Yeah, I can see that. In talking about your hotel stay, I know last time you told us you were having some challenges with the sort of the family life and badminton, you know, mix. When it came to going to Thailand and actually having that alone time to focus on your performance, were you also able to connect with your family a bit more compared to other tournaments?
Well, I definitely had the time to do it, because I was basically available for a phone call any time of the day. But I would still say that the balance between traveling and family has not been easier during this badminton restart after we started again this year. Because now the tournaments are lasting even longer because we need to arrive earlier for quarantine, and flights are not available every day. So you can't just go home as soon as you lost. It's not that easy as it used to be. It's also a lot more expensive. So that is actually still my biggest concern. We're playing the European Championships next. But after that, we will go to Asia again for the Malaysia and Singapore Opens. And we need to arrive 1 week prior to the event again to quarantine. So it's going to be a 3-week trip. And I actually had agreed with my wife and said to myself before, I didn't want to do any more of these 3 weeks trips to Asia. I only wanted to go at maximum 2 weeks. I think I maybe mentioned that last time as well. But I don't really have much of a choice now, because if I only want to go for 2 weeks now, it's only going to be one event. And if I want to maintain my ranking, if I want to maintain the chance of playing these big events, I can't really choose not to go. So it is a bit of a concern, and also a little bit of a problem for my wife in terms of her career. But yeah, it is what it is. And we've decided to prioritize my career. So that's what we do for now. But yeah, as I said, it is a concern, no doubt.
Definitely. And I guess that week of quarantine is just like a wasted week that, you wish you could just go there and play a tournament. Just speaking from an Australian perspective, there are, of course, very strict quarantine laws returning back to Australia from anywhere, even if any tournaments. And that's a big challenge the Australian players face, in that two tournaments becomes not 3 weeks, it becomes 5 weeks, because there's 2 weeks quarantine back home. And that's very, very challenging. Now, in terms of Denmark, what are the restrictions or the rules when you return back to Denmark?
Yeah, well, it's been changing all the time in Denmark. After we got home from the January trip, we didn't have to quarantine at all, actually, because we had an exemption because of it was work-related. And there were also some rules that if it's for an Olympic qualifying event or World Championship qualifying event, you also have some exemptions. It's been up and down all the time, changing all the time. When we got back home from All England and All Young Masters, which are the latest two events I played, we had to quarantine for, the rule says 10 days. But if you test negative on day 4, you can go out again when you get the result on day 5. So basically, it's just 5 days of quarantine. That obviously adds a bit to the challenge of getting my family life to work, because it means I can't go and pick up my son from kindergarten or get him there or anything. So I can't really help at home. I can quarantine at home, so I can be with my family. I'm just not allowed to go out into society. And then you can discuss if that makes sense, because I could pass on the virus to my family. But that's how it is in Denmark. We haven't been as strict as in Australia. And I think you can see that on the numbers as well. We've been hit a bit worse. But there's no doubt if I had to quarantine for 2 weeks after coming home from the events, I would not be playing. It's as simple as that. It just wouldn't work for us.
Yeah. And just thinking about the Australian perspective again, the expense of, going into hotel quarantine. I was speaking to a family friend who's coming back from overseas, and she has to pay, I think it was $2,000 just for the hotel quarantine.
It's crazy. It's crazy. And I have so much respect for not only the Australian players, but also a lot of the Asians. So they have the same rules that it's 2 weeks in quarantine when they get back home. I know even there was a photographer from China who was taking photos at the Thailand Opens. He had to quarantine for 3 weeks when he got back home. So he was in Thailand for 4 weeks because he had to arrive 1 week early. And then he was there for both the Open tournaments and also the World Tour Finals. And then go back home, quarantine for 3 weeks. And he became a dad 1 month before leaving. So he didn't see his daughter for 7 weeks in a row. I thought that was just so crazy, but I also really respect the fact that he went there and he just wanted it so badly. And it's the same with the players. I know in some way they maybe don't even have a choice, because if they want to do this as a profession, what can you do? But it's not as simple as it looks on TV sometimes for people to just play badminton. Right now it is actually quite complicated, and you do sacrifice more than you would usually do. So I have a lot of respect for those guys, no doubt.
Yeah, definitely a huge commitment. And 7 weeks away from the family to take the photos is amazing commitment. So HK, you talked about the hotel quarantine. We'll move on from Thailand in just 1 second, but you talked about your match preparation and your, I guess, with the quarantine, you played well in the first tournament, you played really well in the second tournament as well and made the finals. Now, what do you think you're going to take into your normal tournament preparation now because of the quarantine? So you learned that you could spend more time focusing on matches and not be tempted by going out and visiting the city or, trying some street food or something like that. Which parts of those do you think you'll be able to maintain into your normal practice now?
Yeah, well, I think that is the main lesson I took, that I won't be going out as much. Like, it's not that I won't be going out at all, but I just want to, especially when the tournament is going on, so when I'm still in the event, I will try to just stay more focused on my recovery all the time instead of also trying to maintain a kind of a social life. I know it sounds simple and you should, of course, always focus on that. So it's just like a little tweak in how much I want to do it. You could also say that I'm an experienced player on the tour now. I've been to most of the places, Kuala Lumpur, Jakarta, wherever we play. So I don't maybe have the same need of having to go out and experience the city. So that is kind of the main lesson I took with me. But we'll see when we get back to normal life, how will I cope with it and how strict I'm going to be with that new rule. Because as I said, the temptations aren't really there now. So right now it's pretty easy. When we went to All England and All Young, we also couldn't go out. So yeah, right now it just makes sense. And we'll see when things open up again. But in terms of my other routines, I didn't really change anything. I was watching video like I usually do. I was doing my physical preparation as I usually did. So I think the only real difference was the amount of time I spent on just relaxing and not doing anything else, basically.
And of course, the meagering, which we can't forget talking about before we move on. We're going to just hone in on the diet for that week, HK. just because I think from what we've heard is that chicken was the meal of every day. And if you got fish, it was super exciting.
Correct.
So maybe chicken every day is the fuel for champions, or the fuel for you specifically, HK. But what do you think made the difference? Was it the chicken or was it the mee goreng? And if it's the mee goreng, please give us a summary. And hopefully we can also direct some of our podcast listeners to your episode of your podcast about the mee goreng as well.
Yeah, well, luckily, the Danish team, we quite quickly found out that it was actually possible to order a bit of room service. You just had to pay. It was all the free meals that were only chicken or fish when it was the luxury meal. So we had two or three choices you could choose in room service. So I didn't eat that much of the chicken, actually, because we found out pretty quickly it was dry and dull and not a very nice experience. So I would have to say, obviously, it's the mee goreng of the brand Indomie. That's very important. I'm not sponsored or anything, so this is just my personal experience that it is a really nice instant noodle. And it's a fun story. It all started with me uploading a photo of some different brand of noodles that I brought from home. I had a suitcase full of food that I brought to Thailand because I kind of expected the food to not be great at the hotel. So I had some instant noodles. It's not something I eat a lot, but it's just easy in a hotel room, right? Where you have a kettle so you can boil some water and it's an easy extra little meal. But when I uploaded that photo, I got a lot of messages from Indonesian followers that Indomie is the best brand in the world. I needed to try that. So when it was my birthday on one of the days, the Indonesian team manager, he gave me two packs of Indomie as a present. I ate one and I put up a post saying I would rate this one 7 out of 10. And then the Indonesians went absolutely berserk, like, how can you only rate it 7 out of 10? Why not 10 out of 10? And can you describe what is a 10 out of 10? Because we need to try that. And obviously there's like 15 or 20 different flavors of Indomie. So I was just rating that particular flavor 7 out of 10. But it went viral from there. And at a point during the second tournament, the one where I made the final, a big Indonesian Instagram account made a post that for Anthony Ginting to qualify for the World Tour Finals, I needed to beat Lee Chuk Yew from Hong Kong. And then a few followers thought it would be fun to say, hey, we will give you Indomie if you beat him so Ginting can qualify. And then I replied to some of the comments in Indonesian. I know a little bit of Indonesian just from studying it on Duolingo. So I wrote, I want 1 million packs of Indomie. And I wrote that in Indonesian. And then it just went even more rival and people started tagging the CEO of the company. And he actually saw it and said, okay, if I win, I'll give you a year's supply of Indomie. And then when I won, he actually was true to his word. He wrote a direct message to me and saying, hey, I need your address and everything so we can sort it out. And I did receive, I don't know how many packs, but too many. I have a cupboard back here just full of Indomie. And as I said, I don't really eat it so often. It's mostly on trip. So yeah, I have so many noodles now that I don't even know what to do with them.
That's so good. That's amazing. And yeah, you're the Indonesian hero after that, the new Indonesian hero.
Yeah, definitely. Even Ginting, who qualified when I won, he as soon as I had won the final point, and it was a pretty epic match, I won 21-19 in the decider. As soon as I won that point, he sent me a photo on Instagram of one pack of Indomie and saying, hey, Indomie is coming for you. That was also a nice touch from him.
Does your family like the Indomie?
Yeah, actually, my wife is into it as well. She's actually a bigger fan of noodles than I am. So I think she's eaten more packs than I have since I got them sent from Indonesia.
Well, at least it's going to good use because 1 million packs of Indomie is going to last you quite some time, HK.
Yeah, true. I didn't get 1 million packs, so he wasn't true to his word on exactly that, but he sent me what I think would be at least a year's supply, so I actually had to give out some to family or friends because I'm not going to eat it all in 1 year, no doubt. It's too much for me.
If the Indomie CEO is listening to this episode, make sure you send the remainder of that 1 million Indomies to HK so he can share it with everybody as well. And potentially just give him a sponsorship, Indomie sponsorship.
I worked hard to get that, but it didn't really work out, unfortunately. So now they're just getting a lot of free advertisement, but it's okay. It's all fun for me as well. And if I got anything out of it, it was in terms of, I can't say payment, but I got 10,000 new followers on my Instagram account, and that's quite a bit for me. It took me 15 years of badminton to get to 35,000, and then I got to 45,000 in 1 week because of that story. So that says a lot of how crazy it went in Indonesia.
That's hugely impressive. And I'm sure a large portion of those 10,000 Indonesians or fans of Ginting are now obviously fans of yourself as well. So that's super exciting for you, HK. Now, we'll move on from the Megaring, because if those of you who are listening, if you want to listen to more of HK's Megaring story or hear it again, then make sure to check out You're on Tour with Vittinghus. But now, HK, as a veteran podcast host now and a two-time guest of the Badminton Podcast, we will do something a little bit different here. So for those of you who are listening and would really like to know HK's story, then make sure to check out episode 17. But today we're going to talk about sort of what's happening in the world of badminton. The story is kind of very different from where you are around the world with ongoing lockdowns affecting millions of other people. And there isn't really much certainty out there, even with, you know, the professional circuit and the tournaments. Now, one of those uncertain things is, what will the future of our scoring system look like? Now, as we all know, matches are currently played in a best of three format, with the winner of each game being the first to 21 points. Now, before we talk about what's being proposed by the BWF, HK, you've been in the sport long enough to have been through some of the scoring system changes. So can you give us your experience of the various scoring systems?
Yeah, well, I played with the old system where you played to 15 and you had to hold the serve to actually score points. And I've tried the best of 5 to 11 with the running score like now. I've tried to play it actually both with setting at the end of the games, so up to 15, but I also tried it where you just finish at 11-10 if that's the score. I even tried the best of 5 to 7, I think it was, where you still had to have the serve as well to score points. And I even tried one tournament in Denmark where they were trying the best of 5 to 9.
Oh, wow.
With the score system where you needed to have the serve to hold the serve to score points. And I say, like, in general, my experience is that the running score system is definitely an upgrade in terms of the excitement of badminton. Not for me as a player, but more as a spectator. I think what goes for each of those systems, I would say my love of the game and my enjoyment of playing is exactly the same. It makes absolutely zero difference for me if I play to 15, to 7, to 21. It's all the same. I just love playing badminton. It's really that simple for me. Of course, the dynamics of the game change a little bit in terms of also your thoughts on court and stuff like that. But the love of the game is exactly the same for me when I play. But I do see the differences in terms of excitement as a spectator, depending on the system. And I would never want to go back to the system where you need to hold the score, hold the serve to score. But yeah, before going too much into the new proposal from BWF, I'm a fan of the current system. And what I like with this system is that there's I would call it a grind to kind of get to the deciding points. You need to be able to withstand that physical grind there is midway through the games. And I kind of like that. I don't think the physicality will disappear in the new system, but it will just, you'll have to go further into the matches before the physical part actually plays a part. And I'm a physical badminton player, so I prefer the current system. But again, I'm going to enjoy playing just as much, no matter what the scoring system is. And that is my experience over the years.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people can agree with you that the rally, we call it rally point, basically, where you can win the point on any rally, not just the one that you serve, has definitely made the game probably more exciting from a spectator perspective. But I think also from a player perspective, I think a lot of people do appreciate that as well. Now, with the proposed changes now from the BWF, which is going to be best of 5 sets to 11 points, so that format, and of course their idea in doing that is to increase the excitement and to make it more television friendly, which we don't disagree that that is something that badminton needs. We need to be more on television more. We need to be broadcasted more all over the world so that everyone can learn to appreciate how amazing the sport is, regardless of the scoring, right? And this is proposed to start after the Tokyo 2020 or 2021 Olympic and Paralympic Games. So let's just say it did go through. What do you think will happen? As in, what do you see the changes being to the game? Maybe as you speak from an athlete or a player perspective, as well as maybe a spectator, do you think it's going to achieve those goals that they've set out to achieve with this score change?
I think they will definitely achieve some of the goals. One of the other goals is to shorten the length of the matches as well. And I have no doubt that that will happen in the start. We tested this scoring system before. We had a full year of the Danish league playing with it, but there were also a few events back in 2017-18 where they were testing it before voting about the change back in 2018. And everything looked like they were gonna, it would be shorter matches in general. And that's actually the one thing I don't like about it. I think it's the wrong direction to go, that we want to shorten our matches. I think on average, high level badminton is around 40, 45, 50 minutes, something like that. I don't see that as too long, not at all. Football matches are 90 minutes, tennis matches even longer. And actually, on the contrary, I would prefer that the best matches, they go on even longer. Because if you look at the All England final with Victor Axelsen and Lee Sijia, it was 1 hour and 10 minutes, I think. I wasn't bored at any point. That's exactly the matches that you want to prolong. But that is going to be one of the effects, especially in the beginning, that the matches will be shorter. I think, as many others also say, that the game will probably be a bit more aggressive, because people will feel like they need to dominate and control the game a little bit faster. You can't try and just wear down your opponent. Or at least I think people will have that mindset in the start, that you need to be more aggressive from the start. But I think that is going to fade out slowly, because the exact same thing happened when we changed from the 15 system to 21, that people thought, now you can't just sit back anymore. You need to be aggressive from the start. You need to go all out, because every point counts. And that's what we saw in the beginning. And now I think badminton is back to being, especially in singles categories, more all-round game. You play a lot on physique and trying to tire your opponent a little bit before being aggressive and going for your counter-attacking opportunities. I think that will happen with the 11-point system a few years down the road as well. Because if there's one thing we're good at in the world-class level, it is to adapt. We adapt all the time to changes in different playing styles and stuff like that. So there's no doubt to me that people are going to adapt at this level. I'm a little bit more curious to see what is going to happen on recreational level, actually. That's my biggest concern about the change, that I don't think it's a good road to go down in terms of recreational badminton players. And we only 500 professional badminton players in the world, if we even that many. So I think they should be more concerned about how it affects the millions of badminton players that are out there. And I'm actually a little curious to hear you, Henry, what you think about it. Would you think it's better to play these faster games compared to the longer ones? Because I guess you're also a badminton player where you play because you enjoy the game and you also want to do a healthy workout, right? And now they're actually shortening those workouts, right?
Yeah, well, interestingly, HK, I'm quite the polar opposite of you. I'm not a very physical badminton player. And that was illustrated on the weekend when I decided to try and play a competitive singles tournament for the first time in about 8 years and realized that I had forgotten how to move around the court. And the court was actually quite deceptively big. So I think from my perspective, what would benefit me the most is sort of that 11 point. But I think as far as if I were to play singles again, but I think from a social badminton perspective, I'm also quite curious to see what would happen there. I think when we shifted from the 15 point to the 21 point system, there was sort of this lag behind the change. So when I went to social badminton, people would still prefer to play the 15 point system. And I can imagine that with this change, no one's going to want to play an 11 point game and then have to rotate off the court. I'm pretty confident that most of the players that I know of are going to want to and prefer playing 21 points because it just gives them more time to actually get some physical kind of workout, even if it is a social level play. So yeah, I think it's going to be a weird one. And I really do hope that it, you know, I guess for me and Jeff and yourself, you know, loving the sport so much and you want to see the sport grow. I just worry that we're taking a step back in doing this. So yeah, I am very curious to see what's going to happen there. Now, moving on from that is, I wanted to actually get your perspective on something because from what we could tell from other badminton players out there, professional-wise, it didn't seem like the BWF had much consultation with the professional badminton players. Now, that may or may not be true, but yeah, I just want to get your thoughts on had BWF consulted yourself or other players out there just to seek your opinion as to what you would think it would do to the game?
Yeah, well, I think some players have been a little bit harsh on BWF on this matter, actually. There's lots of things that BWF can do better, no doubt about that. But I think in this case, they've actually done what they should do. First of all, it's not the BWF who are actually putting forward the suggestion. That was the case back in 2018, but this time it's actually the Indonesian Badminton Association and the Maldives, and they're backed the Badminton Asia, the Confederation as well. So it's actually those three who put forward the suggestion. So BWF, they can't really do anything apart from accepting that it's being put forward, and then the member associations will vote for it on, I think it's the 22nd of May. In terms of BWF asking us, the top players, about it, they haven't done that directly, but we do have two spots on the board of the council of BWF. So we are represented by Mark Sweepley, is the chair of the Athletes Commission right now. So of course, it's his job to kind of convey our thoughts about it. But I think, like everyone else, that there's no consensus that everyone wants the same, to keep this system or get the new one. So it's difficult to say what we as players, professional players, want. But I'm also a little bit against the opinion that we should have a big say. I think we already have a big say in terms of we have this spot at the council. But again, we are only 500, 400, whatever number of badminton players. And this is a change to the laws of badminton. It affects millions of badminton players. Of course, we are important as the top level players, as role models and stuff like that. But this is a change that's much more important than just for the current group of top players. This is for all badminton players. So I don't think we should have a bigger say than we do. And that's why I think people have been a little bit harsh on BWF, because I don't see what they should have done different in this case, in this particular case. There are other cases where I don't think people are too harsh on them. But that's for another podcast.
That's another episode. No, I think, HK, that's a really interesting perspective and something that I certainly didn't think about. So thanks for bringing that forward to our attention as to, it is really about the bigger picture, isn't it? It is, there are a few hundred of you professional players, but then it affects Henry, who plays at the local club. It affects our friends who play, recreationally as well. So that's a really good perspective to have. And at the end of the day, it's just what's best for the sport. And I'm sure the BWF do have that in mind as to what's the best for the sport as well.
Yeah, definitely. And if I can just interrupt you, because I had one more point that I wanted to get across, that if players don't feel like they've been heard enough, I think it's down to the fact that they don't know how the political system works. So I don't think they are actually necessarily aware that if they want their voice to be heard, it would make more sense for a guy like Victor Axelsen to put pressure on the Danish associations, because those are the guys who actually have a lot of votes at the AGM in May. And that's the same that Momota should do. He should speak to the Japanese Federation, or Sindhu should talk to the Indian Association, because those are the votes that are actually going to decide if there's going to be a change or not. We can talk as much as we want to BWF, but there's no one hired by BWF that's going to vote about this. Of course, BWF, the guys working in the office, they want the change because those were the guys that proposed it back then, but they don't really have any power to change it. They don't have power to change the laws of badminton. So I think players, if they really care strongly about it, they should try and convince the federations what the right choice is. But yeah, I don't think a lot of players actually know this is how the system works.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that's a very, very good point for everyone out there to hear. So HK, before we move on, I just wanted to ask you, because you did say that you have played in this point system before in the Danish league, just from your opinion, how did that go with the players? How did you go in the league? How did the players find it? Just, it might be a bit of a test demo or a bit of an example as to what the players actually felt like and how were the matches? Were they those really attacking games that we think they're going to be?
Well, I think generally the singles players seem to find it fine. Like some players, of course, liked it more than 21, but it wasn't like people felt a huge difference in singles, whereas the doubles players generally didn't like it because they felt like the matches never really got any kind of rhythm. because it was often just serve, return, third shot, and that was about it. And then you were already at the end of the games before you really started knowing your opponent and getting into this rhythm with a little bit of longer rallies. So I think that was the general feeling, that singles players enjoyed it more than the doubles players. I did feel like it was a more aggressive game at the time, but what I thought was also quite interesting was that, yes, maybe you saw a few more surprises, but it was still the best players who won. And I think you will see that as well, that it's not like we changed the scoring system and Momota and Victor are not the best anymore. Of course, they're still two of the best players because they, as I said before, we adapt really well and they're going to adapt as well. That's some of the things they do the best, and they're still the best players. The same goes for women singles, women doubles, and so on. So yeah, we might see a few more surprises, and we did that in the league as well. But overall, the experience was that it's still the best players who are the best players. It is like that. But I think it's more suited for singles straight out of the block. I think doubles will take a bit longer to adapt.
Yeah, you just have to come out firing in doubles, wouldn't you? Just to get to those 11 points, you know, you'd get through your first 5 points and it's almost over. So it'll be definitely very interesting to see that play out. And as you said, the most successful players will be able to adapt and the best players will always be the best players. So HK, shifting gears a little bit, I want to talk about a player, and it's not going to be Kento Momota. It's a player that you had to meet on his way to the finals of probably the most unusual All England that you've ever played, given everything that's happening. And this player's name is Lee Zijia. And I'm sure there are Zijia fans out there dying to know, because Zijia is a very interesting player on the circuit. What is it like to be playing against him?
Yeah, well, in this year's All England, it wasn't a lot of fun because he was playing insane level, I thought. I had only played him once before when he was still an upcoming player at the Thomas Cup in 2018. I also lost at that time, but at that time I threw away big leads in both the first and the second game. So I actually had a good feeling of what I needed to do to beat him. In general, I don't like to play tall players, actually. That's definitely not my cup of tea. And he's obviously a very tall player. The problem for me when I play him is that I don't trust my defense enough. That's a big part of my game, usually, that I'm able to trust my defense and kind of wear my opponents down. But I'm a little concerned when I have to lift to Lee Zijia because he has so many weapons. His smash is extremely hard, but he also has his slices and these half smashes that are so steep and also quite disguised, actually. So yeah, that's my problem, that I don't trust my defense enough. So I feel a little bit stressed when I play him. And that's just not good, because then you're playing more net and his net game is out of this world. It's, I would say, even tighter than Momota. It's so tight. Like when I played him in All England, I felt like I couldn't do anything when he played tight net. I said that to Kenneth, my coach, many times as well. I feel it's so tight that I can't play net again. And if I try to lift, it's going to be short because the angle is just not there for me. So he was basically impossible for me to play. And I lost 12 and 13. So that's a sort of thing. I didn't really stand a fair chance. But he's definitely one of the guys that we need to keep an eye on. But it's also going to be very interesting to see how he now handles this new situation where he is the guy that we are watching out for and people are expecting a lot more from.
Yeah, he definitely sounds like he's a player to watch, and he certainly seems like a player to watch from his performance at the All England. So we'll continue to see his progression, and hopefully when you do get a chance to play him again, that you're able to take on those nets and be able to defend your way out of it.
Yeah, sure. I will try my best, and I enjoy the challenge of playing him, no doubt. And I would also still believe I have a chance, but it would take just a really big mental effort for me, because it's not easy for me to convince myself that I can do it. So it will take a lot of effort in terms of my mentality and mindset during the game. But I will always believe I can win. I do that no matter who I play.
Yeah. And look, you've seen some really great success in 2021 already, HK. And now at age 35, still on the badminton circuit, what's next for you?
Yeah, well, as we are recording this one, it's the European Championships that are on my mind. Might have been played when we release this, but that's the main focus right now. But for 2021, I have one goal that's bigger than anything, and that's being part of the Thomas Cup team in October in Denmark. I really hope it will be an event with spectators, because playing the Thomas Cup at home is going to be a, I would say, almost magical experience if there is going to be a crowd. The Danish badminton community has been so excited for this event ever since we won the host bidding. I don't remember when it was, but some years ago. And there was so much disappointment when it had to be rescheduled and cancelled and rescheduled again. So I think the community here is so ready for it to happen. And it's a big dream of mine to be part of the team. And obviously, when we're there, we don't just want to take part, but we are going to try and go for another gold. There are teams that are on paper better than us, but we can field, especially in men's singles, we can field very strong lineup. So on our day, we can beat any team. So yeah, why not try and go for gold? And that's the biggest goal for me this year, to be part of that team.
Yeah, 100%. Because we, on the last podcast we spoke to you on, you were talking about the finals victory you had in the past, but then this time in Denmark, that would be insane. That would be the parties. I don't know how long the parties would go for.
No, I think it might be the end of my career because I would never stop partying, right? No, obviously, I would keep on going. But yeah, we would really, it would be celebrated, no doubt about that. We celebrated in style when we won in 16 in Kunshan. A lot of us felt the tiredness and everything afterwards for a couple of weeks. So I imagine it would be pretty crazy if it happens in Denmark too. But yeah, it's also a long road to winning that event, but we will definitely try and it will be amazing to be part of. I just really, really hope that there will be spectators in the stadium at that time. And I think there should be a good chance with how the vaccinations are moving ahead here in Denmark.
Definitely hope for that. Okay, HK, so we're coming to basically the last question that we have been asking many of our podcast guests more recently, and it is your
prediction. I'm so ready for it. I already know. I already know. But yeah, I'm sorry for interrupting. Fire away. I'm so ready for it.
So we've got the gold medal predictions for the men's singles and women's singles events in Tokyo, the Tokyo Olympics, which is in July, August this year, 2021. So who is your tip for men's singles and women's singles?
So you want the boring answer first or the surprise answer first?
We want your best answer. We also want the surprise one afterwards, but you have to lock one in first.
I can do that, but I was more like, for one of the categories, I have a surprise answer, and for one of them, I have a boring answer. I only have one answer for each.
Oh, okay. Perfect. Perfect. Surprise us.
Okay, for men's singles, I'm going to go for someone who hasn't been mentioned yet. And it was actually never my plan to reveal this because I'm also going to be a commentator for Danish TV. So you have to promise that this is going to be between us and your listeners. No one else can know, but I'm going to go for Anna Santonsen. I think he's going to win. And I said that also before the Olympics last year. I thought that he's going to spring a surprise and get the gold home to Denmark. And I think I'm the first one to say that on your podcast, right?
Yes, you are, definitely. We'll reveal the running poll after you've revealed the women's singles vote.
And in the women's singles, I'm going to go for, I think it's the most popular choice on your podcast as well, Karolina Marin. I've seen her in a lot of world championships and Olympics. I was there in Rio and also in London and in Denmark when she won the world championships. She just has something special when it comes to these big events. I think every time she's managed to push her limits even further and just basically kill people with physicality on court. And I think it's going to happen again. The stadium in Japan is very slow, which is perfect for a physical player like Karolina, where technique is a little bit less important. So for me, she's a strong favorite, actually. It's not that she can't lose, but yeah, for me, I would definitely say she's the main favorite for the gold in women's singles.
Yep, definitely not a bad choice picking the number one leading women's singles in our poll as well. So just for all those listeners, as well as at UHK, for men's singles, we currently have Kenta Momota at 7. We have Victor Axelsen at 4. And now we have Anders Antonsen at 1.
Yes.
So who knows? It could be. It could be. It was a very nice surprise for us. And I'm sure it was a nice surprise for Anders, if you're listening. Hopefully you're listening, and the listeners as well. So women's singles, we also have Karolina Marin at 8. We have Tai Su Ying and Okuhara tied at 2 apiece. So there you have it. That's our poll. And we'll continue to share that with our new guests until we get to the Tokyo Olympics. So HK, once again, thank you so much for joining Jeff and I on the Badminton Podcast. before we jump off, if you wouldn't mind sharing where our listeners can get in contact with you and check out your podcast as well.
Yeah, sure. My podcast is available on basically any platform, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast. Just search for Vittinghus. They don't have to type in the full name. If they just type in Vittinghus, it will show up. And yeah, if they want to get in touch with me, they can either send me an email, if anyone out there still uses that, on ayearontour@gmail.com, or they can just DM me on Instagram. My Instagram handle is hkvittinghus. So I think that's the easiest way to get in touch with me. I usually, if people are polite, I will answer everyone who writes to me.
Awesome. So if you have any dying questions to ask HK, make sure you send him a very polite message. Okay.
It doesn't have to be very polite, just not something where they ask, and then if they don't get a reply within 5 minutes, they start sending question marks and new questions and like, hey, why are you not replying? Then I won't reply. So just be polite in terms of respecting that. I also have other things to do than replying to questions all the time.
Yeah,
that's basically all that I ask for.
Yeah, so be polite and be patient, everybody. Well, thanks again, HK, and hopefully we'll see you again on another episode of the Badminton Podcast.
I'll be happy to come back, guys. I enjoy it, and I also enjoy listening. And as I said before we started recording, I'm very impressed with your activity, and I think it's great that there's a lot of badminton-related content out there. I think it's really important, the work you do, and I hope that your podcast will just keep on growing, because I really do think that getting more badminton-related content out there is one of the main things that we need.
It's definitely the way to grow.
No doubt.
Thanks, HK.
Thanks, HK.
Thank you, guys.
So from Henry and I at the Badminton Podcast, thanks for tuning in to this episode. If you've enjoyed it or found it useful, be sure to share it with your family, friends, teammates, and someone outside your badminton circle too. Because with your help, we can show the world how incredible badminton is.
To keep up to date with new episodes and who we're interviewing next, make sure you connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn at The Badminton Podcast, and on Twitter at The Badminton Pod. Feel free to contact us and ask any questions, give us feedback, or request topics for future episodes. We love hearing from you. And remember to check out and shop for your simple and minimalist badminton gear at volantwear.com. Catch you on the next episode. Bye.